Welcome to today's program presented by the Health Trust and the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. My name is Frederick Ferrer. I'm the CEO of the Health Trust. It is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Julie Gerberding, former director for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, is an agency of the United States Department of Health and Human Services. It works to protect public health and safety by providing information to enhance health decisions, and it promotes health through partnerships with state health departments and other organizations. The CDC focuses national attention on disease prevention and control, especially infectious diseases, environmental health, occupational safety and health, as well as health promotion, prevention, and education activities designed to improve the health of the people of the United States. Before becoming CDC director, Dr. Gerberding was acting deputy director of the National Center for Infectious Diseases, where she's played a major role in leading the CDC's response to the anthrax bioterrorism events of 2001. She joined the CDC in 1998 as a director of the Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion, where she developed patient safety initiatives and other programs to prevent infections and medical errors in the healthcare settings. In 2005, Dr. Gerberding was named one of Time Magazine's top 100 innovators of the year for her leadership in modernizing the $9 billion agency as it faced unprecedented challenges, including new and emerging infectious diseases and bioterrorism. Forbes magazine listed her among the world's 100 most powerful women. In addition to serving as a delegate to the World Economic Forum, Dr. Gerberding recently received the Surgeon General's Medallion for actions of exceptional achievement to the cause of public health and medicine. Dr. Gerberding is here today to discuss the challenging effort to make America the healthiest nation in the world. Please help me welcome our keynote speaker, Dr. Julie Gerberding.
Thank you so much. As a citizen of California for 17 years, I can't tell you how wonderful it is to come home and to see the beautiful Bay Area again and to have a chance to catch up with some old friends. So thank you very much for the honor and the distinction of being here. I'm sure many of you have had the opportunity to participate in leadership training and development courses, and people learn a lot of things about leadership, what leadership is, what leadership isn't. But the most important thing that I learned about leadership was something that Billie Jean King said once at a congregation of a large number of women executives. And she said, in only the way that Billie Jean can, leadership is a privilege. I've had the privilege of serving at an agency that I think is one of the most important institutions in America for the past 10 years. But part of that privilege has been my experience being able to travel to local health departments, not only in the United States, but around the world, and really get an appreciation for where health is happening. And I want to assure you, as we begin our discussion about America and this region as the healthiest nation and the healthiest region, respectively, that health really is happening in a lot of surprising places. Just to begin that statement, I'd like to share with you one component of a journey that I took a month ago that really brought this message home. This is a family that I met in Ethiopia, family and some friends, and that is their home in the background, a small and very humble hut. This family is part of a movement to create health in some of the most difficult environments in the world. The family is now enjoying bed nets for all members of the family that are treated with insecticides so that they're not at risk for malaria. The family has now a latrine for the first time so that girls can have privacy and the family can benefit from better hand hygiene with the water system that they've installed for very little money in their own backyard. Their house now ventilates the stove to the outside of the house so they don't have respiratory problems. They have clean indoor air, and they have learned to store the dung that they use for fuel in the roof of the home, not on the kitchen counter, so that they're at much lower risk from exposure to foodborne diseases. Much of this health happening in this home in Ethiopia is attributable to women like the woman in this photograph who are home extension workers or health extension workers. And in Ethiopia, the government and the wonderful health minister, Minister Tedros, has made the decision that if you only have so much money to invest in health, it needs to be invested in the places where it can create the greatest amount of health with the best value for the people at large. He made the decision that in Ethiopia, that was to invest in 30,000 health extension workers who are now out there in villages all over the country creating health along the lines that I've just described. So that's just one example of how innovation and a respect for the fact that there are not unlimited resources for health and that we've got to make smart choices about where we invest them so that we can afford to give people the best possible health equity. These things are happening around the world. But the question that we're facing today, is that happening here in this region and in America? Is health happening in Silicon Valley? Is health happening in America? Unfortunately, I don't think the answer is uniformly positive. As many of you know, we are the nation that spends by far the most on health and health care. But we are not the healthiest nation. We're not even in the top 10 of healthiest nations by any measure that the WHO uses. And in fact, by the most common measurement, overall health status, we're 27th in the world. But when you look at the health statistics at WHO in terms of the value of the investment we're making in health, we're 72nd in the world. Every single other developed country is further along than we are, and many developing countries are ahead of us. So there's something drastically wrong with this picture. And my message today is basically, leadership may be a privilege, but health is not a privilege. Health is a right, and we have a long way to go to make sure that all Americans and people everywhere can enjoy the hope and the optimism and the personal development that that right engenders. There are some very serious aspects of our national health gap. One of them is that if we do not make significant changes in how we invest our health dollars, our children will be the first generation that will have a shorter life expectancy than we do. This is a fact. And of course, a large component of this fact is the obesity epidemic and the overweight epidemic and the lack of physical fitness and the horrible nutrition that too many of our children experience from the day they are born all the way through their entry into adolescence and adulthood. So it is this alarming statistic that is fueling the worry that we will now be seeing early onset heart disease, early onset diabetes, and early onset of a whole host of other problems, chronic in nature, that will be afflicting our children as they go into their early adulthood. It's also important to appreciate that Americans, by and large, are actually not very satisfied with their health. If we look at survey data from the national health surveys, we can learn that even in the best state, which the time this survey was taken was Connecticut, even in the best state, almost 50% of people rate their health status as either poor or just fair. And in the worst state, Mississippi, the number is shockingly large. So we are not living in a nation where people believe that they have achieved their optimal health status, and people are fundamentally not satisfied with their overall health situation. And more importantly, they're worried. We have data from more than a year ago describing Americans' concerns about their health care system based on whether they intended to vote Republican or Democrat in the upcoming election. And I think there are some differences among parties, but the bottom line here is that most Americans believe that profound change is needed in our healthcare delivery system, not just incremental or quick fixes, but profound change in the way we deliver health services to our nation. And more importantly, at that time, which was more than almost 2 years ago, Americans were very worried about their ability to continue to have access. That was before the financial catastrophe. So we can only imagine what these statistics would look like if we repeated the survey today. So we're worried, we're not happy, our children are endangered, and that creates a requirement for change. But I do want to say that while we are very concerned about quality and access and affordability of our health care delivery system, we have to be aware of two things. First of all, we have to be aware that access is not just about demand. There's also a supply issue here that is not getting very much attention. I'm showing a map right now that illustrates counties in America that do not have doctors. And there are a few counties in America that do not have any physician. Most of these are very rural parts of our country, so it's not entirely surprising that there wouldn't be a local physician in these counties. But now I'm going to show a map that shows the counties in America that do not have obstetricians and gynecologists. And as you can see, the majority of counties in America do not have obstetricians. So when you ask, why is our infant mortality rate so high? I don't think you have to look very far to know the answer to that question. So let's not forget that while there is a demand side of this, meaning people need access to health services, there's also a supply side that we are missing some of the most important frontline health professionals necessary to assure that women and children and their families have the basic health services necessary to assure a healthy start in life. If that wasn't enough, I think we're also come right up against the issue that is on the minds and attention of all politicians today, and that's our economic crisis. America businesses cannot compete in the global market if we don't get a handle on the required investments in the health payments for the benefits of our workers and how poor health, chronic diseases, and other conditions affect the productivity and the presenteeism of our workforce. GM was very visibly aware of this even before the financial meltdown when they recognized that they spent $4.6 billion on health care, that it adds $1,525 to the price tag of every GM car you buy, that Toyota paid much less because they had a very different way of providing for health services for their employees, so they had a competitive advantage compared to their American counterparts. And that fundamentally, according to Warren Buffett, GM is a health benefits company that happens to produce cars on the side. Now, this is not just about GM or the big three motor vehicle producers. This is an issue that plagues an entire sector of industries. Failing to address the healthcare crisis would be the worst kind of procrastination, the kind that places our children and grandchildren at risk and threatens the health and global competitiveness of our nation's economy. That from Richard Wagner, the CEO of GM. And then finally, from an economist who's very familiar with the statistics of this issue, this isn't just about the automotive sector or the transportation industry. This is an issue for industry after industry after industry in America. And we have failed to come to grips with this so that where we are today, now that we are in a financial crisis, is not just dealing with the national health gap, but also the financial gap. We've got a two-headed monster in front of us. And these two challenges are inextricably linked, and we cannot create a solution to one without creating a solution to the other. So I've spent these minutes setting the stage here to try to mobilize energy around how critically important this issue is, not just from the standpoint of social justice and the right that people deserve to experience of good health, but because it is an absolute imperative for our nation's economy and security that we do a better job at addressing these issues. So what I'd like to do now is to play a video for you that was created about a year ago, a little less than a year ago, when people like you came together for what we called the Leaders to Leaders meeting, where we pulled people from a whole host of sectors together to discuss the issue of why we are not the healthiest nation and what we as leaders needed to do about it. And some of the members of the audience, which included, by the way, the person who produced On Natural Causes, and we had a wonderful panel on social determinants of health, but there were some creators in the audience, some media creators, and they were so inspired with the conversation that on their own, they just went back to their company, their public relations company, and they created this short little video that I think captured the heart of what we need to do and why we need to do it. And I have found it to be helpful in opening up the conversation, so I thought I would share this video with you today, recognizing it was not done as professionally as advanced media, but something that really came from the inspired hearts of some very talented young people. So let's show the video. So I think the message of this video is that if we inspire our hearts and we really think about our values and what matters to us, we can find the energy and the mobilization to really create effective change, even in the context of a lot of other competing priorities in our society and our nation. So to begin, I think it's important that we ask ourselves the question, why aren't we getting the value that we need to be getting out of the investment that we're making, and what do we need to do about it? And I want to emphasize one very important point here. When we talk about health, we're not talking about something that happens in a hospital. You don't go to the hospital to get healthy. You go to the hospital to get disease care or treatment. Health doesn't happen in the healthcare delivery system. Health happens at home. It happens in the grocery store, on the playground, in schools, and in the places where we work and live and play. That's why our public health departments are so critically important, because they are all about creating health and healthness in the community. And the backbone of what we're trying to accomplish here isn't about healthcare reform. It's about creating health in the most holistic sense of the word at the community level, and in a sense, rebalancing our investments so that instead of spending 97% of our money on disease care and most of that at the end of life, we're actually investing in the kinds of environments and systems and support that help people start life healthy and stay that way for as long as possible. So we can do better to get value out of our resources. Now, when we came to grips with this, just as Minister Tedros did in Ethiopia when he said, well, we only have so much money to spend in Ethiopia. We better think through how to invest this. We looked at, okay, here's where we are as a nation. We need somebody to lead change. And everyone looked this way and looked that way, trying to figure out who would that be. And all of a sudden, it kind of collectively dawned on all of these leaders from these various sectors that, oh, there was no they who was going to take this on. It was going to have to be us. And that a small set of leaders really could create change. I love this quotation from Margaret Mead that never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world because, indeed, that's the only thing that ever has. So an alliance was born, not a CDC alliance. Believe me, it's not about CDC or even our state and local health officers whose organizations are also part of the founding backbone of this process, but a broad coalition of citizens, most importantly, moms and dads, employers and employees, and organizations, which is rapidly growing, the Healthiest Nation Alliance, or technically the Alliance to Make Us Healthiest, us being U.S., a wonderful expansion of people who understand and believe that while our nation's attention is focused on healthcare reform, that we need to move that conversation upstream. So let me tell you a little bit about that alliance and what it's doing and why I'm here, because the issue of making Silicon Valley the healthiest region in the nation is exactly what we want to see happening. We want people to step up and say, yes, we can be the healthiest community. Yes, we can be the healthiest business. We can be the healthiest school. We can be the healthiest family. We can be the healthiest church. We need people to make the commitment at where they are to do everything they can to say, we don't need to wait until somebody solves the problem for us. There are things that we can do right now to get started and create the context for broader policy changes to emerge and really create the transformational change that we need. So I'm going to ask all of you to commit to joining the alliance, which is very simple. You just go to the web. It's healthiestnation.org, and you'll be able to sign up. But before you do that, you should know what you're putting yourselves up for. So the first principle of being a member of the alliance, whether you're an individual or an organization, is to talk the talk. And by that I mean fundamentally committing to a subtle but very important change in the conversation that we have about health. We need to be talking about health in the holistic sense. We need to be talking about the health system. Not the healthcare system alone, but the overall health system. And we must talk about health equity, because one of the biggest barriers to change is that so many Americans do have good insurance and are enjoying the wonderful benefits that our healthcare system can provide to us. But we've got to assure that those benefits are accessible for everyone. The health system is more than hospitals and clinics and doctors and nurses. It's even more than healthcare delivery plus public health. The true health system is you. You as parents, as people who are educators, as organizations at the community level, as faith-based organizations, educational institutions, businesses, and certainly the broad stroke of government leadership. The system is all of the components of our society that contribute to health in one way, shape, or form. And the most powerful member of that system is guess who? You know, not the president, not the Secretary of Health and Human Service, whoever that may turn out to be, but it is, in fact, Dr. Mom, because Dr. Mom makes about 83% of all the health decisions in our country. So if we want to have more health in our society, we've got to engage moms at the family level in what some of the solutions might be. And that's part of what this alliance is all about. But because we're here in Silicon Valley, I also think it's important to talk about health infrastructure. And one of the most important pieces that's missing in our ability to understand and transform our health system is, of course, health information technology. Electronic health records from the healthcare delivery side, but also personal health records from the consumer side, and how these things can be knit together so that you as individuals have the ability to understand and use the knowledge about your health status and your health system to make better choices. This is beginning to emerge here at Microsoft and at other places that are in the forefront of technology, but it is not yet an accessible dream. And one hope that we all have is that the economic stimulus package will leverage broad investments in health information technology to get us past the dream phase of this and into an environment where we can begin to appreciate the promise that having the knowledge about health can really create for us. It's no longer about getting data. It's about using information at the consumer level, the family level, and the system level to understand and affect change. That also, of course, leads into the issue of integrating information from a broad variety of sources. I'm showing a graphic of biofusion, which is an effort to take advantage of existing traditional and non-traditional health information and fuse it together in ways that helps us understand the scope and magnitude and onset of emerging health threats. This is similar to what Google is doing with the flu tracker. They're now using search engine data to predict when flu has arrived in a community, and it looks like it can do it earlier and faster than even our best information systems at CDC. So these kinds of infrastructure investments can really help jumpstart us in moving toward talking the talk, but we have to talk about health infrastructure investment, not just infrastructure investment as it pertains to bridges and roads and so on and so forth. This is your governor, Governor Schwarzenegger, making the plea for infrastructure improvements, and he certainly understands the complexity of getting that concept supported at the taxpayer level. But it's important that all of these leaders understand that health is just as much a part of our infrastructure as is transportation or energy. And that's part of talking the talk of the healthiest nation. We have to get policymakers to see the broader context. What we advocate is the concept of health in all infrastructure. So if you're going to build roads to stimulate the economy and put people back to work, then make sure those roads come with bike paths and safe crosswalks and street signs that allow seniors to get across the street without getting mowed down, et cetera, et cetera. Or if you're building a better school or renovating a school, make sure that includes a clean cafeteria with healthy food options, a playground, well-lit classrooms, clean air in the school, and so forth. That if we're going to invest in things that wouldn't necessarily be considered health, then at least try to leverage the health benefit that those environmental investments can make. And there's tremendous opportunity here that we just need to make sure is on the radar screen when those plans are being rolled out. Just to give you an example of what the payback here is, at CDC I presided over a $1.6 billion capital improvement project, which, by the way, was built on time and on budget. But it was an important realization for all of us in Georgia, and particularly the Georgia delegation has been fantastically supportive of CDC, to recognize what the economic value of that investment was in Georgia. For every $100 million we spent, we created 2,100 jobs, put $248 million in economic impact, and $77.5 million in worker earnings in our state. So that's why infrastructure is such an important part of economic stimulus. If you can build fast, you can get people back to work fast, and upstream, downstream job impact is tremendous. But guess where we desperately need buildings and facilities? Our public health departments are deplorable. Even with the preparedness investments that have helped some improve their laboratories and some modest improvements in infrastructure, most of our nation's public health infrastructure is back in the 1950s and something that we should all be dreadfully ashamed of. So let's make sure that public health buildings and facilities are on the agenda when we talk about health infrastructure investment. Now, let me talk about another very important component of investment, because I think our business leaders and our academic health leaders and our health sector understand why investing in NIH and biomedical research is so important. Because not only does this create new solutions to people's health, but it helps create products and services and technologies and drugs and diagnostics that move our economy forward, create products that add to our gross domestic product and help us create more exportable options for people in other parts of the world. So this is a tremendous health advantage, but it's also a tremendous economic advantage to our country. And I'm all for it. I love NIH. I wouldn't be here today if I hadn't had an NIH training grant when I was growing up. So we're totally committed to the ability to take basic science and translate it into better health outcomes for people. We have some tremendous gaps in this process. We have missing knowledge in terms of new solutions for problems like Alzheimer's or schizophrenia or diabetes, many of the common problems. But we also have tremendous gaps in order to take what we know and use it on an applied basis so that most people can benefit from it. So there's every reason to think about NIH as part of the infrastructure investment. But that's only a piece of the problem. And there's a whole other talking the talk piece here that I must emphasize to you, because health research isn't just biomedical research. There's also a component of health protection research, the kind of knowledge that we need in our public health domains to move population health forward. This is also a kind of research that starts often at the bench or at the most basic community level, but has to be translated into studies that show what kinds of community interventions are effective at supporting better health in a population of people, what kinds of tools and resources and capacities are necessary to take what we know works and scale it up so that it affects people broad enough to move the needle on the dial on health. And then ultimately, how do we measure the health status of people and recognize what's working, what's not working, and what do we need to do differently to get that value out of the investments that we're making? This pipeline of translation from a population health perspective is absolutely under-supported. It is the missing piece of health that very few people realize and appreciate, because we're enjoying genomics and the whole kind of basic science approach to thing without recognizing that we've got to fill in this entire pipeline along this line, and there is an enormous gap. We estimate that for CDC's mission alone, our health protection mission, we have the knowledge to address about 10% of the problems that we are accountable for solving. There's a 90% gap in not knowing what we know to make the difference that we're expected to be making. That's a tremendous opportunity. Part of the reason this hasn't happened already is a failure to recognize that not all research is NIH. But also, we haven't been thinking about the research and development product opportunities that come into this line of operation. There's tremendous business opportunities here. Just think about what's happening now as the technology sector is beginning to think, well, how can we enable health by giving people monitors that check their blood pressure while they're driving, or monitor their heart rate and so they can upload it into the computer, or online coaching, or all the wraparounds that go as we begin to put our creative minds to this new dimension of health. Tremendous opportunities here, but we've got to prime that pump, get this thing going, and recognize that it's just as important, if not more important, than the biomedical disease treatment model that we've also come to value and respect. So that's about talking the talk. Talk health, health system, and I use using the word health system reform as the performance indicator. So when I hear someone talking about health system reform, I think, aha, that person could be a champion here. I want to talk more with that person. And when people talk about healthcare reform, I'm not sure where they are. And I try to always move them a little bit further up the stream. So you can help with that. So let's talk about the second aspect of being part of this alliance, and that is walking the talk. This is the fun part. This is where you get active and actually begin to do things. And I'll just walk you through how I think about this. First of all, as I said, we're all leaders. And leaders have a tremendous opportunity to lead by example. I'm showing a photograph here of an village elder in West Africa, who came forward when Secretary Leavitt visited this village to get an HIV test because Secretary Leavitt got an HIV test. And what do you think happened when this gentleman got an HIV test? All the other men in the village wanted to get an HIV test. So leading by example is so critically important. You need to really recognize how powerful your personal leadership is in motivating people to take the steps that they need to take to lead themselves to better health or their families and organizations to better health. I was so inspired by Fred talking about the health trust and how walking the talk meant getting a walking coach and getting the employees of the health trust out for the AIDS walk and also for the Run for Your Life effort. So demonstrating by their own actions that they're committed to the concept of health and willing to do their part not only for a cause they champion, but for a cause that is somebody else's primary leadership to champion. So leading by example is important, and I said this yesterday and I'll say it again today. For those of you that are particularly recognized as being part of the health sector, you have to be really careful how you shop. So, you know, if you go to the drugstore and you purchase a certain cough medication, people are watching you because they think you might have secret knowledge about which one of these products actually is the best product to treat your cold and flu symptoms. So be aware that your influence isn't always direct. It can be indirect, and it's so valuable and so underutilized in so many ways. So I challenge you to lead by example. But also, not just you, lead your family to action. These are photographs of my family, and my husband has never seen this photograph, and he would be shocked and appalled. But this is my husband in a friend's pool, and he's very buffed. He, as a trainer, he works out all the time. We're very committed to staying healthy and fit. The lower picture here is one of my gardens. I am an avid gardener since moving to Georgia, and that's how I get my physical strength training, but also my mental health. When I'm in a bad mood, I go out and dig in the Georgia dirt, and when I'm in a good mood, I enjoy the beautiful things that are out there to appreciate. So it's part of how our family responds to our need for both mental, physical, and spiritual health. The other photograph is of one of our cats who is unfortunately licking the Thanksgiving turkey. And we have some improvement to make in food safety in our family, but we're working on it. And I will also tell you that we lead by example in terms of preparedness. We don't always think about preparedness as an aspect of health and health protection, but it absolutely is. David and I have a pantry, and I investigated our pantry. And I wonder how long we could live in a pandemic based on what's in the pantry. And it turned out if we wanted to eat rice with barbecue sauce and drink a lot of wine, we were in really good shape. But I think that's another example. And this Christmas, for my friends and my close colleagues at work, I gave books on the relationship between diet and cancer prevention because I wanted to lead by that example. And I've spent a lot of time with my family talking to individuals about cancer screening and the importance. In our family, where we have a strong family history of cancer, it's a way that I can lead my family to action. And I encourage you to think about how you can reach your extended family through similar steps. This is how we become healthier, by taking personal action, family action, and using our own networks to expand that out. Speaking of that leadership, we all belong to an organization, and you have to ask yourself the question, is my organization doing what it needs to do to support the health and safety and well-being of its workforce? Are we an exemplar? If you're a hospital, you should be an exemplar. If you're a business, you should be an exemplar. If you're a health sector organization, you must be an exemplar. And for me at CDC, there was a no-brainer. CDC had to be the exemplar of the safest and healthiest workforce. And when we started this effort, we didn't know what we were doing. We had lots of great ideas, lots of very smart scientists who had evidence around certain things. But we had never really turned that inward in a leadership way to say, it's not just about dabbling in this. We need to commit and really do this right. So those buildings that I talked to you about that have been built are all LEED certified buildings. The campus has reduced its water consumption by 15%, and we've built beautiful stairwells in every new building so that when you come in, that's what you see, not the elevator. Our scientists in our chronic disease center have done work on what motivates people to take the stairs at work. And it turns out if you happen to have a fire escape in the back of the building that's disgusting, you cannot expect people to ever be on that staircase. But if you light it, carpet it, paint it, allow employees to maybe put their children's school artwork up there, you can really get some people to take the steps. If you turn off a couple elevators, you'll get even more people to take the steps. But if you want people to continue to take the steps for the long run, you need to put music in the stairwell. But isn't that a nice thought, to be able to just get on the staircase and hear something pleasant or fun as you move from one floor to the other? But the point is, it's not just about being tobacco-free or having employee benefits that provide for certain kinds of wellness screening, et cetera. It's about living health in the context of how you engage and work with your group every single day. I came back to San Francisco in August to work at San Francisco General Hospital, which is something I try to do every year. Imagine how thrilled I was to step into the hospital campus and see this banner on the hospital that said, "Smoke-free San Francisco General." I cannot tell you how hard it was for that hospital to become smoke-free, given the patient population that it serves and the traditions there. And the commitment that people made and the pride that they felt in that is something that really was just a wonderful experience for me personally, since that's the hospital that I trained in. But also just being so proud of being from California, where our state has done the most to really commit to tobacco. And if you can't do anything else, for goodness sakes, work not only on your environmental policies around tobacco, but make sure that your employees have access to quit lines and cessation support, because that is fundamentally one of the missing pieces in our fight against tobacco. And that's something that we could all rally around as the single most important thing we need to do to improve the health of people in our country. And there are tremendous health disparities in tobacco use, not just here in our country, but increasingly around the world. Now, how many of you have a life outside of work? Not very many hands are going up in this room. So I think most of you probably have some life outside of work, and that means you have other networks. You know, maybe it's your church or your PTA or your Girl Scout troop or your book club or your gym, whatever it is. People belong to other kinds of social organizations. You need to think of yourself as a virus, so that you're taking this idea from this social network and introducing it, infecting your other social networks with the same idea. Because that's how social movements get started, through viruses moving, ideas moving from one network to another. And the scale and speed which that can accelerate is unbelievable. That's how SARS spread. You know, that's how flu spreads. So imagine how powerful a compelling idea could be if you begin to share it widely with the other groups that you come in contact with. It's probably one of the single most powerful things that you can do to support health, better health in this region. And lastly, along those lines, I do want to talk about those of you who are more senior leaders or who are leaders who really intersect reliably with opinion leaders, influencers, spokespersons, and those who are truly in positions of responsibility for making decisions. I'm showing a photograph of Secretary Leavitt, the former Health and Human Services director, with a number of health leaders, including the former director general of the World Health Organization, the head of the Institute of Medicine, the head of the NIH, and various others who had a strong stake in pandemic preparedness. And what happened during the beginning of the launch of our efforts to try to bring our nation into a better set of preparedness for a catastrophic situation like a pandemic was we used a principle called META leadership, M-E-T-A leadership. And what that really is not leadership in the traditional sense where you're leading vertically in your silo, which we all learn to do, but leading horizontally across organizations. When you are trying to influence someone whose budget, money, space you don't control. So it's leading by negotiation, leading by influence, leading by finding a shared example. and a shared agenda, and finding those areas where you're in alliance and you can leverage each other's self-interest to create a whole that's greater than the sum of the parts. And what I see happening here in this region, the reason I'm here and the reason I'm so optimistic about this valley and this commitment that you're making to be healthiest is that you are meta-leading this effort. Health Trust has convened a wonderful group of meta-leaders here who represent all kinds of organizations, and you're influencing each other to come together and commit to this grander village so that collectively you can move this agenda forward far more powerfully than any single agency here alone. Even the health department could not possibly do this alone. So it's very important to leverage that kind of leadership with a shared agenda and to learn the skills necessary to do this well. Having said that, I also believe there are some people who should be in this room who aren't here. I don't see a lot of the business sector leaders here. And I think one of the important steps that needs to happen in any community to fully gain the momentum and the power to make a difference is to get the private sector engaged. So I hope that that's the next phase of your meta leadership and your network development, is to get all of the influencers to recognize why this is a shared imperative, not just something for the health people or those do-gooders, but something that is vital to the economic viability of every single enterprise in this valley. So finally, just to conclude, walk the talk and talk the talk. The last component of being part of this healthiestnation.org alliance is to talk the talk. And I'm not going to talk about this in detail, but I just want to point out one aha that I experienced about a year ago, and that was how poorly we measure health. We measure disease very well. We can tell you how many people have this or that, or how many people smoke, or how many people are overweight, or how many people do this, that, or the other thing. But how do we really measure health in the holistic sense? What are the measures of well-being? I would challenge you to think, if there was one indicator of health that you thought would stand out, what would that be? Would it be how satisfied people are with their health? Would it be how optimistic they are about their future, their children's future? Would it be the absence of all the negative things? You know, one statistic we don't publish is we say how many teenagers smoke, how many teenagers have babies, how many teenagers have STDs, how many commit suicide, how many are in car accidents. But we don't measure how many teenagers do none of those things. And that's what we need to do with our thinking, is convert our measurement and our metrics so that we really are measuring healthness and that we measure it in terms that citizens can understand. So there is an effort underway now to begin to create health indices so that a community can say, you know, San Jose health index is such and such, or our scorecard is such and such. And we can compare that to Palo Alto or San Francisco. And then leaders can begin asking questions, why is ours so poor and theirs is so good? What's the difference? What do we need to do about it? Chambers of commerce will begin to take notice. Businesses will say, ha, this is not good for recruiting new businesses into our area. This isn't good for our children. And you begin to engage the community because they can understand the information in ways that right now are fairly obtuse or abstract for most people. So this talking the talk is important, and we are working on that, and hopefully we'll be able to come back in a very near future with some learning around this and some experiments that show the way forward. So the Healthiest Nation Alliance is a national movement. It's an international movement. There are other countries now that are signing on. Australia is engaging. But it's also a local, and it's mostly a local movement about talking, walking, and chalking the concept of health as the right that everyone in the community should be able to enjoy and experience. And, of course, by doing that, you are automatically addressing the health disparities that right now are of a tragic proportion across America and even here in Silicon Valley. So I challenge you to take this journey, to think about how we might go from where we are today, which is a very low investment in health protection, But with a little more investment in the upstream part of our health system, I think we can gain tremendous health value and turn the corner on this very, very difficult environment that we see affecting not only our children, but our national economy and our long-term security. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Gerberding, for sharing your insights with us. We have over 30 questions that have been asked by members of the audience, so I'm just going to select a couple to ask Dr. Gerberding, and I've kind of picked ones that of areas that she didn't talk about and maybe get her insights. The first one is, I noticed that spirituality was not mentioned as part of holistic system of health. Do you see spirituality as an important component to health?
I absolutely do see spirituality as an important component of this. I personally view spirituality as a very personal issue, so it's not something that I necessarily share or talk about in public. But as I mentioned with my garden, it is my spiritual haven, and I have others, but that's one that really puts me back in touch. And I just can't imagine that, from a holistic sense, that physical, mental, spiritual, and social health are all part of that holistic equation.
Do you agree with Surgeon General Koop that fluoridation of public drinking water is the single most important measure that a community can take to ensure oral health?
Yes. Absolutely yes.
It is very difficult to get people to change behaviors. The environmental movement knows this, but media can help. Please discuss how we can more effectively utilize multiple media vehicles.
One of the things that I've decided to do in this transition time for me, having just left government, is to try to understand better the gap between what we know we need to do and what we actually do as individuals or as a society. And I'm actually spending a little bit of time with Edelman Public Relations Firm, because it's a very good firm with values that I think are strong and I support. But at the same time, they're in the business of trying to influence people's lifestyle choices. So if they're marketing, shall we say, a condom, what do they know about how you get people to be interested in sexual health, how you get people to use condoms? They may know they should, but they don't actually do it. What's the gap? Why is it there? And I think part of the challenge we have is the science around those kinds of behavior decisions, the cultural approach, the social behavioral approach, the anthropologic approach, the social network approach. That's part of the missing science in that public health transition pipeline that I talked about. And I'm hoping that I can gain some insights myself as I observe how professionals who do this in a private sector, what kind of tools and approaches they use that we might be able to use in a public sector. It's part of the reason why we created a new National Center for Health Marketing at CDC, because we do this poorly. And if we really want to create substantive change in human behavior, we're going to have to get a lot smarter about how we approach it, because it isn't what people don't know, it's what they don't do.
What can Silicon Valley government leaders do to address health inequity?
The first most important for a step for a leader, in my opinion, is to listen and learn about the scope and magnitude of the problem, and then to begin to use the bully pulpit that you have to engage others' attention. You might not be able to affect the policy changes that are necessary to address the problem quickly, but you can usually find some low-hanging fruit. And here in this place, there's one low-hanging fruit that should be obvious to everyone, and that's the fluoridation of the water. So there are clearly things that can be done right now today that would have a profound impact on the health of the children and the adults in this community with a very short lag time. And a leader who can latch onto one of those and carry that ball across the goal line has a much better chance of bringing the next, a little bit harder score to bear. So I think, first of all, being willing to listen and learn. Second, using the podium to influence others to come on board. And then third, taking some action that has a result to lead the way toward more opportunities to take on tougher challenges.
With 1 in 4 Americans affected by mental illness, how important is mental health care as we work to be a healthier nation?
There's a conversation that I often find myself in when we discuss health versus well-being. These are obviously very related components, and we tend to think of health not as a state, but as an enabler. But well-being is a state. Well-being is that integrated, holistic ability to feel optimistic and hopeful about where you are and where you can go in your life and the confidence that anything is possible. And mental health is absolutely foundational, and it is one of the biggest areas where we have enormous disparities in our country. I've had a struggle at CDC because mental health is not part of our portfolio. We are not funded for it. It's not been a traditional part of CDC because it's part of SAMHSA, another organization. So we said, let's meta lead this. We cannot hope to get a mental health budget at CDC, at least during that time period. But what if we tried to work with SAMHSA and shared agendas? And their leader was totally on top of this. And we came together as leaders. We brought our leaders all together. Then we exchanged experts. So at CDC right now is one of SAMHSA's top scientists. We're beginning to blend our survey questions, use similar approaches so that we don't have to replicate each other's work. And the best part of it all, when it came time to propose some budget initiatives, CDC's number two choice was a mental health initiative, and we said there's no way we'll get this funded, but what if we support SAMHSA's mental health initiative? So we went forward to the department and said, listen, it's so important that CDC wants to be a champion for SAMHSA to get this money. That doesn't happen very often, but I think it illustrates how committed we are in public health and recognizing the gap and trying to find innovative ways to provide the support and the resources that you at the local level need to create those integrated solutions.
One of the biggest costs of healthcare is the gatekeepers, the bookkeeping, the insurance companies. How are we going to transform our healthcare system to spend more money on actual health and away from private insurance?
I don't know. There are so many good ideas floating right now because everyone sees this as the golden opportunity. And I've read all of these policies, and there are some incredibly exciting true solutions. But the reality of getting from where we are to those solutions is a really rough road. And it's going to take not only a visionary policy approach to get the best possible balance among the various stakeholders, but it's going to take a leader who can truly meta lead, probably one of the hardest leadership challenges our nation will ever face, not only to lead the various health stakeholders, but to lead the Congress. And that is a tough challenge, and it will be interesting to see whether it's approached incrementally. Like we started with Medicare and let's do SCHIP and move forward piece by piece, or whether the approach will be a one, you know, macro package. The landscape is very different right now than it was even a year ago because the most influential people recognize the need for change. We can talk about the CEO of GM for one, but there are a lot of other people who recognize from only an economic perspective that we are on a path that cannot possibly sustain itself and change must happen. And I think there's a much greater willingness now to find the compromise or the opportunities for a different approach. But I do not know myself what the best solution is. I've tried to learn everything I can and contribute our perspective. My job has been to make sure that whatever that solution is, it includes health protection and upstream health, not just health care.
Unfortunately, we've reached that point in our program where we have just time for one last question. And the question is, do you have any advice for an aspiring agent of change?
Never, never, never give up.
Dr. Gerbini, do you have any other final comments?
my comment really is congratulations, and thank you for the privilege of being here to speak with you. Fred, thank you so much for your vision and your leadership, because I know this wouldn't have happened without your own energy and passion and meta leadership. But you've given me a great gift, which is to reaffirm what I've believed for a long time, is that health, all health, ultimately is local, and it is the hearts and minds and energy and experience and passion of the people who are on the front line that really make it happen. So I feel energized and inspired, and I will try to tell your story in other places so that maybe we can influence others to do what you're doing. It's a beginning, and it's a strong beginning, and I think you really will be able to make a difference. Thank you.
I hope you all enjoyed today's program brought to you by the Health Trust and the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Dr. Julie Gerberding, former director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, our audience here in Santa Clara, and those who are joining us on the radio. And now, this meeting is adjourned.